I'm Trisha Helfer, and you are listening to After the Credits at row3.com.
The Q&A that follows was recorded after a screening of the Canadian film Normal, and the screening was presented by the First Weekend Club and features a Q&A with director Carl Bassai, actors Ty Runyon, Andrew Arley, and Camille Sullivan. Hope you enjoy it.
This is so inspiring to see everyone come out and support a Canadian film. And I'd like to highlight some of the work that was done to get the word out today. First Weekend Club is really honored to have a few local affiliated partners. Paul Armstrong with the Celluloid Social Club, who is really supporting Normal through his network, and Biz Books and the Casting Workbook and Cineworks. This has been wonderful. And we've also recently developed an ambassador program where film buffs can get more involved. We've got some amazing film students here. And, well, look, we literally, this showing did better than the other films at Tinseltown today. So that's a real testament to the local support. So could we just clap one more time for that? And, I'm just going to introduce what everyone's waiting for. So, Graham, will you come and kindly introduce our wonderful director and cast? And thank you, everyone, so much.
Thank you, Alexandra. Wow, that's the first time I've seen the film, and I was pretty blown away. I didn't know what to expect. That's got to be the best cast I've seen in Canada in a long time. That's all my favorite Canadian stars in that movie. Carl and his producers did a very... Well, actually, you were one of the producers, weren't you? Yeah, did a fine job of putting that together. And I was—I just came back for a week at Victoria Film Festival, and I thought I recognized some of the buildings in that. That was Victoria. I was quite impressed. It looked beginning to look gorgeous, didn't it? Yeah. Nice. A lot of helicopters. Maybe now I can introduce him. Okay. We have some surprises. We promised you that Carl Bassai, the director, would be here, and he is. Carl, welcome. The other nice surprise was I was really, really hoping, I would be wonderful if some of the cast members could make it. And I don't know, who do we thank for that? Did you wrestle them up for us?
Yeah, come out, guys, please, and, you know, answer questions. So we have Camille Sullivan, who played the evil stepmother. And Andrew Arley, who is Carrie Ann's woeful husband. I don't recognize him in his glasses, but it's Ty Runyon who played Dennis.
Yeah, that's a real thrill. I'm really pleased you could all come. That's a very nice surprise for me, and I hope for everybody else. If you don't have questions, I will. So I'm going to give you the first chance to jump in, and you could address these to anybody here, or if you're not sure who, we'll pick for you. But anything at all about the film would be welcome. Don't worry. Let's have a little fun. They've given us a little time. We can stay as long as we want. And again, on the other hand, if you have to go and you don't feel embarrassed to sneak out, we won't take it personally. You're welcome to leave whenever you've had enough, and the rest of us will stay as long as we enjoy it. So does anybody have a burning question right away before we get started? There's a gentleman right in the back.
It's for Mr. Runyon. What research did you do to portray autism? Because it's different for everybody, and it was still pretty believable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Temple Grandin and her writings and videotapes were pretty useful to me. I took a lot from that, and it's a really tough one to tackle because the symptoms are so broad and diverse, and you know they often refer to it as autism spectrum disorder, and honestly the list of possible symptoms include like slight social dysfunction, things that many people have, you know, so, myself included, so it was kind of, I took some liberties, you know, I took a lot of inspiration from my goddaughter, who is not autistic, but very creative, and, you know, has a few habits that I borrowed from, and what else? Some obvious like physical stuff, ear touching and tippy toes, like those seem to be common physical symptoms of autism. So I tried to to put that into. Thank you.
Thank you.
Someone else had their hand up right after that, and I missed you. Okay, well, you'll all get your turn, don't worry. Go right ahead.
Lots of questions.
Start with one, okay.
Tremendous film, ensemble cast.
You're in the front, so I'll just give you that.
No one's ever accused me of being too quiet. Amazing performances, but also really probably one of the most handsome and beautiful casts I've seen on screen for a while. And Carl, it's going to be the cinematography I've seen from you. I guess my question is the handheld camera style and so on, but it just had a different feel to it. And, you know, getting up close and personal with all of these, was that a deliberate choice in the early going, or is it just something that kind of evolved? However it happened, it worked really well.
I kind of thought that the idea for the movie should be that the camera witnesses, sort of a witnessing idea. So what does that mean? I thought, well, let's see what happens when the camera appears to just observe, to not be too fixed on having kind of a classical sort of wide shot and then go in a mid shot, and then, oh, and now it's we'll accent things with a close up. I think that for me the landscape of the movie is in a way the faces of the people. I'm really inspired by people like John Cassavetes. I don't know if you guys know his work, but that sort of amazing, kind of seemingly accidental kind of documentary authenticity that some of those great films have, where you feel like you're just in the room, you're not intruding on the process. And I do the lighting so that I can make the actors, give them as much freedom to kind of just be in the space. So there are lots of scenes where actors are kind of wandering around, or the scene seems to kind of travel a little bit, and the idea that the camera just sits and watches, and if you think about a documentary, you don't know always when you're filming a documentary what's going to happen next. You're thinking some things might happen, but you're never quite sure, so the camera has to be ready to react. And so that's always been it's something I'm very interested in as a stylistic idea, and so that's why I wanted it to be handheld. But I didn't want it to be a super gritty, grungy kind of handheld either, so it definitely has a kind of patina, sort of glow of money and richness and sort of beauty. I mean, in a way, that's the point, right, isn't it, that these lives actually are quite lovely in a way, and yet there are problems in these lives, just like there are problems in everyone's, you know, life or house or home or whatever. So that's I rambled.
Carl, that made me think about the opposite effect. We're literally following people in great close-up sometimes, and we've got some breathing space and we need it. But then the other thing that ties the story together are those amazing overhead shots that were those to draw us into the landscape that the people lived in, or give us some objectivity?
Yeah, and it's like that thing, it's sort of a documentary idea. So I film all this stuff, and then I think, well, what visual idea could I use to sort of tie this together? And it seemed to me, without being too thematically obvious, I thought, well, there's something about this looking down on, you know, in an obvious way, it could be there's this dead kid whose life and death has touched all these people, and there's something about floating around above these people and looking down on their lives and how their lives are all pieces of this sort of map in a way. That was kind of my loose idea. And then I got my friend who runs Vancouver Film Studios. I sit on a board with this guy, and so once a year I bug him for helicopter favors because he runs at Blackcomb Helicopters. And so he gave me he put me in a chopper, and I had 3 hours, including any refueling time. And it was, you know, all or none, right? Just get the shots and get back. 3 hours, you're out. And I had to start in Vancouver, so we madly flew to Victoria, and I had never flown over Victoria that close. I mean, I'd flown in there a lot, but I didn't realize how damn beautiful and kind of rich and palatial some of these places were. And so we would be hovering over this stuff, hanging out this window. It wasn't a window. There's no door, and you sit on this. It's a really fun thing to do, actually. And then I get the pilot to bank turn around these things so I can kind of. And the trick was to find these houses, which I knew sort of the neighborhood. But man, It's not the same from the air. Where was that house?
Aaron, can you go a little to the left?
And I remember this wonderful moment where we had to refuel, and we kind of dropped down in this little, where the helijet goes, and we dropped down right in front of this big cruise liner, and all these people are waiting for their cruise to take off, and they're all hanging out on the back of the boat, and it was like, it felt like you were some sort of fighter pilot, you know, because you're rigged up with this crazy, anyway, I don't know. But yeah, so I was kind of amazed at what that landscape sort of said about the lives in a way.
No complaints from your film.
No, and we tell them, okay, at some point between 3 and 6 o'clock, we're going to be hovering in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
But yeah, those houses, man, they blew me away. And we wanted to shoot the film in Vancouver originally, and we were scouting, and we had one house picked, and it was kind of the shack next to my house, and this park, it was really depressing, and then we were going to shoot on the PNE, in the PNE grounds, which is also really depressing, and I thought, God, this is going to be this gray, and you know what it's like here in the middle of winter, right, so it's going to be this gray, grim, dismal, damn movie, and I was really bummed about it, and then we had problems with a piece of the financing, so we had to shut the production down, which was a real disaster, but then what happened was, we replaced the money, and then we lost so much money, we had to figure out something else, and so we went to the island because there's a bigger tax credit. That was the incentive. And when we got there and started scouting in these wonderful, big, incredible houses and really friendly people who had these mansions and really wanted us to come and film, I just couldn't believe it. And in her house, I don't, you don't notice, but there's a tracking shot it's from me to the wall, at least. It's just this forever track in this person's living room. And I just thought, that's my entire, like, my property, my neighbor's property. You just go, wow, that they would let us in there. So, yeah, there was a lot more production value filming in Victoria, I'm sure.
I think they just like you in Victoria because of Emil and other... Girls shot, I think it's like half of your films are being shot there, it seems. Not everything is unnatural, accidental, which is downtown east side.
It's money, but it's, you know, now with the tax changes, it's 47 cents on the labor dollar. So when I go to Victoria, everyone I hire, I get a kickback of 47 cents. You know, this is ridiculous, right? It's a huge amount of money to go and shoot out of Vancouver. So, I mean, that's how we struggle to make these. Go ahead, let's have some questions.
Yeah. Well, I noticed you made, like, a lot of effort to get the details right, like the number 2 Oak Bay bus and then, like, the grocery store bags and everything like that. So I was wondering if you think it's important as a Canadian filmmaker to sort of, when you're filming locations in Canada, to really set them in specific places in Canada?
I do, but, you know, it's weird. I've been to these markets a lot and selling films a lot where you have these very... warm, friendly discussions with people who are usually, you know, not Canadians. They're maybe from Britain or from the States, and they love your story, they love your script, they love your cast, and they just want to make sure that you don't go out and make it look too Canadian.
Yep.
They say that, and you think, well, and I've been a bit defensive sometimes, and I go, well, what do you mean? What's wrong with... And she said, well, you know, that sort of cheap, kind of cheap-looking film that you guys make, and I think that's really a terrible... It's something that maybe once in the 70s there were some kind of schlocky films that got made, and so we've been sort of labeled in this regard. And I've seen Canadian films where they, for I don't know why, they use American money. I mean, if there's no reason to, but they're still thinking somehow that, you know, by hiding any Canadian reference, it's going to sell better. And I think that's changing. I refuse to do it. I think it's really, it's lame, and really, it's like being a liar, sort of counterfeit. I think we live as sort of service producers. We live with American movies constantly reinventing our cities as, you know, Seattle or whatever. And I think here I am with federal funds and these tax credits that I'm talking about and so on, and I'm supposed to be making a Canadian movie, and I get certain sort of rewards for doing that, and then to hide its place is really insulting. You know, so yeah, I go out of my way to put the Canadian. Go ahead, sir.
Have you pre-sold any territories, and what kind of broadcasters and distributors are interested in it, and what kind of channels do you see it going on?
Well, Canada is quite easy to do that because we have, thank God, CRTC legislates so that the Canadian broadcasters are obliged to put a certain amount of Canadian stuff on the air. Mm-hmm. So these most Canadian films are able to pre-sell the Canadian television rights and Canadian distribution rights, which is why the film's here. In other countries, it's a little tougher, but with Carrie Ann and Kevin being in the movie, there's certainly a larger appetite for this kind of movie. I'll say that small drama is a difficult thing to sell internationally, no question. We've sold it in the States, we've sold it in the UK, we've sold it in most of the English territories now. We've started to do territories in South America, Eastern Europe, it's sold in Israel. You know, so it takes a while, usually from when a film is first kind of launched, which this was in Toronto at the festival this past, the Toronto Festival. It's usually about a year and a half before you've really made a dent in the market. But it's slow going, man. I mean, mm-hmm. honestly, just to put it in relative terms, I did a zombie film, also shot in Victoria, mm-hmm. Severed, made for, I guess, all in about $1 million. So maybe wow. about half of what this was made for. No famous people in the movie. And that film, man, that film made so much money. That film made, it was just mind-blowing how big the deals were on that film because, zombie film, fantastic, don't need to see it, show me the trailer. Oh, God, I love it. Unbelievable. And you know, I'm just scratching my head going, I've got to get back to the zombie.
So you have bigger properties.
Yeah, no, but it's that, you know, there's a huge appetite for genre. There always will be. Yeah. But, you know, when you look at it, I mean, I'm really excited right now because Sarah Polley's movie is getting huge international respect, the Academy Award nominations. And you just think, well, you know, if Sarah Polley can go out and make a film about a woman with Alzheimer's, the pain, the suffering, the beauty, and the sadness of that relationship, and there is an international audience for that film, and it's very Canadian, it's very visibly Canadian, then I think it bodes well for our culture, cinematically speaking. That means that this thing we talked about a second ago about, well, don't make it too Canadian, that's bullshit. That's something that people tell us to keep us down a little bit. And I think sometimes our critics do that to our own films to keep us down. There's a sort of unspoken rule that we need to keep our artists a little bit destabilized, you know, because there's a great secret in this business, which is that our films actually make a fair amount of money for a select few groups of people, groups of companies, you know, and I think that, sorry, I'm getting political, I said I wouldn't, but you know that we have to really fight for our voice in a way, and artistically as a country, and you know, we don't do that enough, and we're sort of content with, I mean, I'm really excited that a matinee's got so many people here, and thankfully we have organizations like the First Weekend Club, because we need to remember that we're not, you know, people with nothing to say. And it's not just this film, it's any film. There's so many good films that we've made that you guys don't even know about because they get kind of unloaded so quickly. They're just, you know, it's frustrating. And I'm not asking personally for a lot. I think that in the grand scheme of things, if every city in Canada, every major city, say 10 cities, had one screening room that was, you know, well presented and that had 20% of the time in that screening room played Canadian movies, I'd be happy. You know, is that too much to ask? Do you know what I mean? That's just so minor, right? But that's more than we can ask for. You know. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just wondering about the screening and so forth. I was at the Quebec Classical yesterday, there, but you know.
There's one thing that that Quebecers understand immediately, and that is that their culture matters. They believe in the cultural mandate. They know that their survival as a culture depends on people seeing their films, listening to their music. I mean, within Quebec, but it, you know, it's interesting that in about 1990, if you would walk into a video store in Montreal and overhear, listen in on people coming and going through the shelves and their attitudes toward their own domestic cinema, scathing, you know, complete scorn. Oh, the Quebec cinema was crap. And it's found a voice, and people have discovered that it's actually high-quality stuff, and there's a kind of a nationalist enthusiasm for it. I mean, could it be possible, maybe it won't be in my lifetime, but could it be possible that Canadian films will become kind of the new Korea or whatever the trendy new sort of brand?
Well, I think
could
potential be. Potential is certainly there.
Sure.
I mean, come up as an outsider.
Yeah.
Obviously, make them more Canadian.
Yeah.
But when I look at some of the stuff in the tunnel version, it's like yeah. Wind at my back, Stern Morality killed some Canadian
yeah.
And frankly, after a while, it gets a bit tedious.
It does, you know? Definitely. But the answer for a lot of people is, well, really to be successful, let's just imitate these American shows or these American films. And I just find that's kind of sad, too. Right?
I think there's plenty of stories
yeah.
in Canada. In BC, you know, one thing I like about like this thing is I see the same people in the movies. You know, it's kind of like seeing your friends in the
yeah.
movies.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I, you know,
sure.
You know, I meet this guy in Costco one time. You know, it's I like that. And yeah. Then you need to go and do the Canadian thing. I mean,
yeah.
Chris Haddock's being great.
Exactly,
thing,
yeah.
You know?
No, exactly.
I think it's just a matter of having the good scripts
yeah.
and a good acting.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Canadian...
But what you say
cartoons,
about...
All I knew about Canadian cinema originally was the cartoons. Everybody knew that Canadian cartoons are good.
Right.
You know, they're kind of
yeah.
oh,
right.
Yeah.
You know, they were well known.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Canadian cinema can be the same.
Yeah, well said. Go ahead, sir.
I just had a question for the gentleman who played Carrion. I was wondering, your character was like so cold and he was like kind of like a rock, and I was wondering how you felt about your character, like not about playing him, but about the actual himself. Is it?
That's actually a question that's better directed to Carl, but I'll answer it in part as well. But before I do, I want to say I commend all of you for coming out and supporting a local film and a local filmmaker, and thank you very much. We didn't have a lot of time to discuss my character ahead of time, so we kind of sketched it pretty quickly once I got over there, because small film in terms of budget and everything else, you don't have a lot of prep. There's no rehearsal or anything. So Carl and I were kind of finding our way the first day or so with my character, and I think Carl's idea was we originally approached it slightly differently, and I moved in Carl's direction with it. That my guy was what you see in the film, and Carl will be able to explain this better than me in terms of why it was edited this way. You see me quite cold in the pieces that you do see me here, but there was a lot of scenes where my character was had actually kept it together a little better than her, and was not sort of sinking to her level, and had been trying to push her on in terms of our, you know, moving past the horrific experience we had. So it's strange for me to watch the film because I know there's a lot left out, I perfectly understand why it was, and that's best for Carl.
We did a test screening early. I always take the cut at work in progress, and I sit down with strangers and just get feedback. And one of the first things that people were unanimously saying was that, why that poor man, that poor guy, and you know what a bitch, and this guy is trying so hard to pull his family together, and you know, wow, I feel for him. And I mean, as much as it's a nice tribute to your acting, it was difficult to have the movie not leave you with some kind of feelings of sympathy toward Carrie Ann. And so it's kind of that, by painting out some of Andrew's words and taking away some of his kind of warmth, I was making their relationship more messed up, but also leaving you a little bit more on her side. One of the classic changes was the dinner scene, which was written completely differently from the way it was cut. It makes it look like he was sort of Get It Together, Catherine, which was an ADR line. Do you remember the scene? You know the one. Mm-hmm. And he's like, God, would you stop bringing up the dead kid? Kind of tone mm-hmm. in his voice. That wasn't the way it was written at all, but we needed to reinforce this idea that this guy really was impatient with her, really wanted to move on, and had a kind of a wall that he put up. And, you know, I'm very kind of naturalistic in my approach, so I always cast people that I feel can inherently... they can inhabit this character because of something in themselves. And of course, Andrew Early's a really nice guy, you know. And so his instincts couldn't help himself, you know. He just, I can't not say this. This, you know, I can't not exude this kind of, you know, familial warmth in these moments. And so I had to cut them out. No,
left to my own devices, there would have been even more to cut out because I actually wanted him to be colder and. More fed up with her. You know, I've been trying for 2 years to move her along, and but Carl pushed me every day. He said, no, I think he's got it a little more together than her. So there would have been less for you to work with. Left it to me. So.
Go ahead, hear that?
Yes.
When you sat there and it's just that surreal look, how many takes did it take to get that?
How many takes did we do?
I think we shot it three times.
Something like that. Three. It wasn't a huge amount.
That look, it was just stunned.
Well, I was a little stunned. That was just real.
that was really good. That was just
excellent. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know, but it was a marvelous scene to film. It was a brave scene for her to do.
Oh, huge.
And it was a scene that worked in that kind of real time way, where the less intrusion, the better. Mm-hmm. So that it really did. I mean, we would run it as a complete. Can you guys hear me? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'd run it as a complete. Scene, including the father coming in, and just let's just not interrupt this. And so I think by the time we started filming the scenes where Michael Riley, that's the father, comes in and, you know, climbs on top of you, she was kind of exhausted and emotionally sort of drained, really worn out, I think, at that point. And I think it just completely works, you know. So it's almost like documentary, right? So you sort of inhabit these feelings because you've been, you know, filming this way so truthfully for, you know, it was hours of that.
Well, I liked when I watched it. It was horrifying doing it, but then when I watched it, I liked it because it's a lot more about what's happening between the characters than actually what was happening physically. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think there's a lot more going on. So I thought that was cool.
It's really interesting how, in theory, you have so much time to rehearse and prepare. Yet film, even though it's still performance, I'm really interested in how you guys were able to build the charisma between the characters. Because I know you don't, well, I'm assuming, you don't have much time to rehearse and prepare like you guys are saying. And yet, I felt this connection between the characters as you would want the film to convey. I'm just wondering what kind of barriers you guys experienced, how you got over those. Like, did you hang out outside of shooting or stuff? I'm really curious to see how that worked.
Well, you jump in pretty fast. Like, you pretty much just jump in. And I think the first scene that I shot was with Kevin when he's leaving, and he takes off in the car with
the Magnolias.
And I'm standing there and I'm all upset. So you kind of just have to jump in and be like, hey guys, you know, nice to meet you. Let's go. But so what do? I think you just try and have an objective and just try and get it from that person, no matter. And I think that's what, because you want something from them so badly, that's what makes you have a connection with them, because they do have something to provide for you. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I'd also like to hear you guys too.
Well, most of my scenes. In fact, all of my scenes were with either Carrie Ann or Cameron Bright, who plays our son. Carrie Ann and I hit it off really, really well. She's a fantastic lady. She was, you know, she's a big name. She's a big star. And sometimes working with those people, at the end, the experience is less than joyful, but it wasn't with her. She was just really down to earth, and you know, we've got kids the same age. We talked about that, you know, sort of before and after scenes. She was terrific, and the rest of the cast. You know, we're, you know, most of us all know each other from around town. So when you know, we've if we haven't worked together in the same scenes before, we've often been in the same films or shows. So there's not a lot of ego-driven stuff going on with your local casts. Well, except with Ty, but he can explain that for himself.
I'm working on it. Yeah, well, all my stuff was done with Callum, pretty much, in 2 days in one room, and it was pretty intense. And Callum and I spent some time together, like, years ago in California. We were both living down there, so I had that kind of rapport to refer to, but I mean, it had been years, and I guess in general, my approach is, I mean, you're right, it's so fast, you just have to dive in, and rehearsal needs to happen on some level, even if it's a talk on the phone or a dinner or like just, so I try and just do as much prep on my own as possible and then get a hold of the other actor as soon as I can. And like, there's some stuff that you don't see in the film. Like I had this whole world set up that Walt was allowed to enter my apartment when he was wearing a green piece of yarn that I'd met up with him and I tied it to his wrist and I'd said, you know, you can come into my home as long as you wear this. And Callum works on that level as well, so it was the crazy level. So he was right into it, and there are moments where, like, I open the door for him, you know, through the door chain, and he holds up his wrist and shows me the thing. I'm like, okay, you can come in. And, you know, just I try and incorporate as much stuff as possible, just to, so there's, yeah. Hopefully it shows up on screen, even if you don't see it, you know, just those kinds of connections and conversations where you pay extra close attention, you know, that kind of thing. Anyways.
Thank you, Jed.
Carl's picking him nicely, too. How about this gentleman who was waving a cigarette? Yeah, right there.
I have a question about the process in deciding to, in the lead up, sort of like, did you decide to make the film, or was there a script already that was made that someone showed to you that you got engaged with, or was it sort of a collaborative process with you and the writer to find the story?
The script existed before I turned up, and it had been read at a Praxis. You know, I don't know if you know what Praxis is. It's like
an SFU student.
Yeah, Praxis?
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. So one of the development people from this company, Brightlight, was at this Praxis thing, and he liked the script. And then they took it into their company, and then it was kicking around for a while. And then I got it because they wanted to work on something with me, and they had a bunch of scripts, and they were like, here, what do you think? And I read a bunch of scripts, and this was one that I thought was some work, could be interesting. And that was in 2003. And so for about 3.5 years, I had a lot of discussions and did a lot of work on the script and traveled the world begging for money and had a lot of stops and starts. And actually the guy who was the development guy at Brightlight then went out on his own, and so we collaborated together producing the film. So originally it was supposed to be really something quite big, done by a fairly big company. And it was just, you know, time. I think when Crash came out, suddenly the market was going, oh yeah, ensemble drama, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can do that. That's good, you know. Mm-hmm. But there are times in the certain years where no one wants to touch this kind of serious film. They want a comedy. We want comedy. That's it, you know. So, mm-hmm. So it was it was a long process. But in terms of the script, yeah, something did initially exist, for sure.
Was it always called Normal?
Yeah. When did Mongrel Media come in? Part?
They came in because originally it was Think Film, and then Think Film was sold to an American 51%. American controlled, so they were no longer allowed to be a Canadian distributor in the kind of required sense with telefilm and the tax credit system. To be eligible for those funds, you have to have a Canadian-owned, majority percentage-owned distribution company involved. So suddenly, Think Film didn't count anymore, and we scrambled around and brought Mongrel in not long ago. I mean, maybe 2 months before we were shooting. So, yeah, it was crazy.
I have a quick question. How early in the development of the project did Carrie Ann Moss get?
Not early at all. I mean, she came in just before we started filming. I didn't even send it to her originally because I thought she was 39 years old at the time. I thought there's no way Carrie Ann Moss is going to want to be read as a mother of a teenager. It'll age her way too much. She's not going to be interested. And I mean, it's funny because Callum, whom I know and had worked on another film, he's the same manager who manages his career. So I could have got to her, but I just thought, no, that'll never work. And I was working on other stuff, you know, other ideas. And I had Marcia Gay Harden attached to this movie originally. And she, it just took us so long to pull the damn money together that she just got busy doing other movies. And then by the time we were ready to go, you know, she was just off doing something else. So it was a real panic because the financing always lives or dies on the back of who's in it. And so I think then I got Kevin involved, and that really helped open up some interest in the States again. And I think, you know, Kevin's such a nice, hot, young actor that that my partner's idea was, well, let's try Carrie Ann, because my friend Andrew Curia did Vido with Carrie Ann. So, and I asked him about it. What do you think about Carrie Ann? He knew the script, and he was like, oh, I think she'd be into it, you know? So it's often like, yeah, that who you know and just getting some advice like that. And yeah, and she did really love the script and didn't seem bothered at all by the age, which is really beautiful. And it's rare. Yeah.
Somebody was waiting right there. Yeah.
How long did you have to shoot this? You said it was 3.5 years.
Yeah.
Did you have to pack it into how long?
20 days. 20 days to shoot it, which is... I remember hearing a friend of mine did a co-production with Spain. It was a film called My Life Without Me. Do you guys remember this?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wonderful director. Isabel Coisset is a Spanish director. And so she came to Vancouver to do this movie. And the producer said, okay, well, we've only got enough money for 30 days of shooting. And she was furious. There's no way she was going to do a feature in 30 days. In Europe, they never, you know. And I would just kill for 30 days.
That'll be the title of the next
one. No, the irony is that I've been to Victoria with three different productions, and every time I go, the moods change over time in these cities, whatever. And so with Normal, the crew was thought it was really long, like a 20-day schedule, because they were now used to 12-day films. And I'm 12 days, like, we actually, Camille and I have just been working on a new film, which we shot in 10 days, but it was improvised with camcorders and no lights. So I could do that in 10 days, but how do you do this? You know, run a whole crew through a movie in 12 days is just crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's not really doing a service to the actors. I mean, I think even with our short schedule, I think the actors, I hope they would agree, but I think the priority in the shoot was always the actors. So let's not fuss around too long. Let's let them act. Let's do as much shooting as we can. And I shoot a ton of film just to keep, so really, let's get everything. I mean, Ty, you remember, it was only 2 days, but we were rolling the whole time. I mean, just
the whole time.
Constant rolling. Yeah.
First off, I just want to compliment the all of you on the consistency of the performances. It was really wonderful to see this level of performance, and I hate to say in a Canadian film, but we just don't see very many features that have this sort of wonderful performance. So, very much congratulations to your cast. My question is, and to go back to your reference of Crash, Crash had sort of a central message of racism. What do you feel is the central message that your audience takes away from this film?
Well, I think, you know, without being too on the nose about it, I think there's a message about forgiveness and about redemption a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think these three main stories, or four really, if you count Dennis as a separate story, I don't think these characters get a big happy ending kiss at the end, you know. But I do think there's the sense that my attitude toward the story was that each of these each of these people is stuck in a kind of neutral gear. Something's happened that stopped their life from progressing, from moving forward in whatever way. They're in a kind of a frozen place. And until they make whatever kind of connection they can make with the other people involved, they're never going to be able to really step that next step forward. And so I think at the end of the movie, you know, you hope that each character has, even if it's small, there's the sense that they've made some kind of motion, at least in some direction. I mean, even Callum's character, who's probably the most defeated in a way of the protagonist, does sort of end the film in a happy place, a little bit, you know, the sense that maybe tomorrow he'll pull his shit together, you know, maybe. I think that's the message a little bit, that's, you know, how does one get over these things that happen, these tragedies that happen in our lives, you know, we've all lost someone. I mean, this happens to everyone as part of life, but it's very pat to say get over it. It's not that easy to get over it, and I think that the film's trying to acknowledge the complexity of that, at the same time say that, you know, redemption's only possible through some kind of community, some sort of sense of people coming together. Boy, that sounds really like a...
And my question sort of has to do with this, too, is that was the script written that this happened 2 years later? Because, you know, you would expect after a year people would move on, but it's quite normal that people don't. So that's what I loved about this. It was real.
Yeah, the original story, the young writer who wrote the original script was trying to exorcise his own demons from an actual death that occurred. His friend was the kid, in a way.
Yeah.
He was like the Geordi character, you know. And I think that's not something that heals in you know, a few months or something. So I mean, definitely that's the point. Yeah.
And I thought it was an interesting choice too, for this gentleman's character to be a little bit remote, because I sort of read it as this is how he deals with his grief. That it's not. He's not bad, but that's almost the armor that he's chosen. Mm-hmm. The fact that he hasn't cried, I think it was an interesting choice, whether it was made in the editing suite or on set. I actually could very much buy that he could be, in a sense, a little opposite to his partner in how the two of them dealt with their loss.
Yeah.
So really nice work.
Oh, thanks very much.
Let's just take like one or two more quick questions, and then why don't we meet outside and in the lobby?
Can,
you know, anyone wants to talk to
Carl.
Just curious with working the actors, if you did have any time to work with any of them before the shoot.
Well, I try and surround myself with people I really know. Like I know them in some way, or I have had some experience with them. And that's sort of something you can't always get lucky at. But Ty, I've worked with Ty on, I think this is our third movie. Third part. Camille, I don't think we've worked together. We've met before, and I'm a big fan of hers in the TV show Intelligence, so I feel I know her. And Andrew, same thing. I was trying to cast him in an earlier film of mine, and it didn't work out, but we just know each other. And so, you know, and Callum I worked with on my previous film. So the strangers were Carrie Ann for me and Kevin. Those were the two real strangers. And you just hope that you'll turn up on the day and they'll really get you and you'll really get them. And I mean, that's the great trick, I think, right? Just that luck that, you know, you can communicate and it's working. Mm-hmm. And when it doesn't, it, you know, it's a nightmare. Yeah, go ahead. What's that? Well, the same thing. I mean, you try to work with people that you know, that, you know, I've had certain experiences with this person. I want them back. Like, I always have the same sound recordist. The camera crew always changes around. I try and find people who get what I'm into. And that's crazy to say, but, like, for example, I went to the Toronto Film Festival, and I saw a movie called Acts of Imagination that I thought was really interesting, the way it was made, the way it was filmed, and it was very much this witnessing idea, this observational idea. And I do my own camera director photography thing, but I like to have an operator because I want to be able to not do everything, you know. And I found this guy from that movie, and he was really young and really inexperienced. And you've always got investors; you have to sort of say, "Well, okay, I'm doing the camera work myself, and I want this kid that you've never heard of to be my camera operator." And they get really nervous. And you have to, it's such an advantage to have people who just automatically they're coming into the project with this total understanding of what you want to do and how you want to do it. And I'm filmmaking is very corporate now. What I mean by that is, it's imagine like the Ford Motor Plant. You know, the cars are perfect. They all match. They come off the assembly line. There are no flaws. But there's nothing special about any of them. And when filmmaking's like that, I feel it's sort of sausage factory. And so you get a lot of people on crews who are used to kind of putting a light down, you know, plug in the cable. This is just this grunty thing that they want to do, and they get well paid for it. And on my film, they're doing the same job, but they're getting like way less money. So why would they do it? So you have to find people who actually do care, believe in the project, or and want to try something different a little bit, because it's different. It just is. Yes, dear.
I have a question. I think most of us are probably First Weekend Club members, so we know to support your film, but we really, I think, generally love this film. And from you, how can we help you? What would you like to see happen from us to help?
Well, you guys know the drill, right? The opening weekend is the way in which distributors and exhibitors measure the success of a movie and if a movie's going to stay around. So I think that, you know, from my point of view, I'm really happy that you're supporting this film by being here today. But I think that in the larger sense, what makes me really happy is when people in general just go, okay, I'm going to give Canadian film a chance. And here's what I think. Think about the 10 Hollywood studio films that you've seen, the last 10. I don't know if it's over the last year or the last 10 years. It doesn't matter. You think about those 10 films. And of those 10 films, how many blew you away that you just love and are so happy that you saw it? Usually 2, maybe 3, I don't know, not 9 of the 10, I doubt, but maybe, right? So my feeling is audiences are always willing to give the Hollywood movie another chance, even though maybe the last one was disappointing. With Canadian films, they're much less, in general, they're much less willing to forgive the odd inadequacy that they might see on the screen. Or, wow, that film didn't speak to me. Give it another chance, because I think that if you give 10 Canadian films a chance, you're going to like 2 or 3 of them for sure. I mean, I do, and I'm very discerning. I'm very picky about the films that I go see. And this country needs to have a film culture. I think it's important. We have a great literary culture. We have a great music culture. Why shouldn't we have a good film culture? We're not genetically incapable of making films, right? So that, to me, is just give those films a chance, and that's why that organization is so great. FirstWeekendClub.ca.